Welcome to another episode of Convergence. I'm Ellen Taylor alongside Michelle McAloon. We take a dive into issues where faith and culture collide. And we always get into some pretty interesting conversations. And today is no exception. First, I bring in Michelle. How are you doing today, Michelle?
I'm doing fine. It might be better than our last recording because I do not have Polish roofers working on my house right now. So it might be a little more silent during this session, but we will see. You know, life is full of surprises. So.
It's always funny. We always worry about outside sounds when we're recording, and it really wasn't that bad at the end result. So don't worry about it. The Polish roofers can get back up there again.
Okay, there we go. All right.
Today, we're going to take a look at patriotism. And in this conversation, we're going to bring in an expert. Dr. Stephen Smith is a professor at Yale in the Alfred Coles Professor of Political Science, I should say. And more importantly, he's the author of a great book called Reclaiming Patriotism in the Age of Extremes. So welcome in, Stephen Smith.
Thank you, Ellen and Michelle. It's a pleasure to be with both of you today.
It's a pleasure to have you, and especially to talk about patriotism, where patriotism is a word that has become much maligned. So this patriotism that, and Ellen too, we were both born and bred on being American patriots, and now it has become a word that is so maligned. So, Stephen, what is patriotism?
Patriotism is now what it has always been. It is love of country. It's a word, it's an ancient word that goes back to Greek and Latin sources. I talk a bit about that in my book also. The book focuses, though, on what is, I think, special about American patriotism. And we can talk about that if you like. But what makes American patriotism, I think, unique is that it is founded in the ideals of our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution in particular. Ours is in many ways uniquely a patriotism of ideas, which is to say, it's not just a patriotism of blood and soil, as it is often thought of in European contexts. It is not a patriotism necessarily of divine promises. Ours is a patriotism of ideas rooted in the constitutional tradition. And that's an argument I try to develop throughout the book.
What is the difference when you look at patriotism versus nationalism? Because it seems people seem to be mixing those two definitions up a bit.
That's right. And thanks for asking that, Ellen, because that's a distinction that's important in the book. I actually make a threefold distinction between patriotism and nationalism on the far side and a kind of cosmopolitanism on the other side. Patriotism and nationalism are easier to confuse, I think, in part because they grow out of a common source. They grow out of an aspiration or desire to have your culture, your way of life strong and respected, and that's a legitimate aspiration of all people. Where they tend to move in different directions is, I argue, nationalism becomes a kind of ideology of us and them. It is an ideology that distinguishes or divides the world between friend and enemy. And it's also one that focuses largely on sort of distinguishing enemies. Patriotism speaks, I think, in a different language. It's a language, as I say, love of country. It's based upon a sense of loyalty, which is central to patriotism, the idea of loyalty to one's people, one's own. But it's a sense of gratitude for who we are and what we've become. But patriotism is also connected with a sense of shame and also feelings of when we fail to live up to who we are. So I do want to argue, and we can go into this if you like, these do speak in somewhat different, I would say, emotional registers, patriotism and nationalism.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you use the word emotion. That really is an issue here, especially when you're talking about something like human loyalty. So right. In patriotism, you have loyalty. In nationalism, you have a loyalty. And you can, I guess, debate whether that is misguided or not, or how can there be a healthy nationalism and a healthy patriotism. But of the two words, patriotism seems more healthy because it almost speaks to the love of your country, to the love of your ideas, and not from a range of superiority, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, I think you make a great point, and it's one in a way that very close to one of the arguments I make in my book. For example, one example I use is the following. I think that we can think of loyalty to country, as part of a sort of concentric circle of loyalty. We have loyalty to many, to friends. We're loyal to our friends. We're loyal to our families. We're loyal to the institution, you know, up to a point, to the institutions that we, where we work. We are loyal to sports teams. We have all kinds of loyalties. Loyalty to country is an important one. So we should think of patriotism as a form of these loyalties, and these loyalties can also come into conflict with one another, which I talk about. But yes, loyalty is not just an intellectual disposition. It's an emotion, it's a habit, it's a feeling. And I try to look into the psychology of what constitutes loyalty and makes it, as I argue that it is, a virtue.
And in the past, patriotism was always considered a virtue, one of the highest virtues that a citizen could have in their country. And in fact, if you didn't have patriotism, it was almost like you didn't care or bordering on or you're a traitor of sorts. So now we've kind of, culture seems to have taken this idea of patriotism and turned it towards something negative rather than one of the most positive elements that a society could have towards their country. And how do we back that up a bit and regroup ourselves to recognize what patriotism is in culture today?
Right. Well, that's a very difficult question. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had a clear answer to that, how we can reaffirm and how can we reclaim patriotism in a world where patriotism is in many quarters not respected and not thought of as a virtue. Let me start by making one observation. Patriotism has in many ways always been a contested virtue. We can go back to the beginnings of Western literature and take Sophocles' famous play, The Antigone, where it pits loyalty, Antigone's loyalty to family, to loyalty to country. And the Greeks and the Romans were deeply aware that patriotism was, you know, in many ways in conflict with other virtues that might exist. Now the question is, as you put it, Ellen, is it a virtue at all in some quarters? And I think by trying to think of patriotism as a species or a branch of loyalty, because we all think in many ways, I think we do, loyalty to friends, loyalty to family are positive qualities in a human being that we have to have, we do have. That I think if we begin to think of loyalty to country as part of that spectrum of loyalties, we might be able to go some way towards reestablishing it, or at least beginning to make the case for why loyalty why patriotism be considered a virtue.
One of the authors that I interviewed recently told me that loyalty is actually about commitment. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to that. What you are committed to, you are loyal to. And to be committed to America means a commitment to both what is good and bad, what is our shame and what is our pride, but still to be committed or loyal to this great American experiment does not connotate something bad. That is patriotism of, you know, love of place, love of family, love of commitment, loyalty to a place. You talk about something called ethos patriotism. What is that?
Okay. Let me just go back to what you just said about commitment, because I think that's very important. That's not the word I use in my book, but one of the words I used, which I think captures some of that, is care. which is to say our loyalties represent a structure of cares, the things we care about most deeply. And those cares shape our identity. They shape who we are. We are in a way, the compilation of the things that we care about. And patriotism is about, you use the term commitment, I use the term care of our country. And that is connected to this point you make about, or that I use in the book when I talk about patriotism as an ethos. Ethos is a Greek word, or it derives, we still use it. It's connected to the term ethics, that ethics and ethos are rooted or in the same concept. One of the things I wanted to describe in talking about ethos patriotism is that patriotism, as I've said a little bit earlier, grows out of the founding ideas and the founding documents that we have, but it is not entirely exhausted by, you might say, these intellectual virtues. And ethos is our shared habits. They are our shared dispositions. They can't be simply summed up in a set of ideas. Our ethos is, to inhabit an ethos is a little bit like a comparison I make, inhabiting a language, the way we speak. And we can often, we identify one another by the language we have, by our manner of speak, our body language. We convey our national identity through a whole range of linguistic and bodily and affects that we have. Alexis de Tocqueville, the great French observer of American life, who I figures, you know, intermittently throughout the book, used the wonderful term. He wasn't using it to describe patriotism, but he used the term habits of the heart. And that's a term that I use also to describe what I call ethos of patriotism. It is a habit of the heart. It is a disposition and a kind of moral habitus that we all share, that we hope we all share.
That's something people choose to be, right? I mean, we think people in patriotism is you're born into your culture or your country. But there seems to also be this American version, which is an honest choosing to be a part of this patriotic feeling that you have or actions that you have for your country. Is it something throughout history that has always been this way, where you were born into it? You hearken back to stories of Sparta and how they were kind of trained up into it. Is this natural in culture and society, and where did, in some places, it get off the rails?
It's natural up to a point, I would say. Patriotism takes different forms in different countries and in different times. So it may be natural in one way, but patriotism is shaped too. It's a creation of the education we receive. And one of the points I make throughout the book is that patriotism is something that needs to be taught. And one of the points I make is that we are failing, both in the high schools and in the universities, to teach a kind of proper love of country. So nature, yes, but I think even more importantly, patriotism is a function of the culture and the education that we receive. And we can't blame people for not being patriotic entirely if they haven't been taught to be, if they're not educated to appreciate and to, as previous generations were, I believe, to appreciate what it is our country has done for us. That's not to say, I think the reason, let me just kind of develop that point for a moment. One of the reasons, a point both of you have made at one point, is that patriotism is now, in some quarters, regarded in bad odor, is because patriotism is thought to sort of paper over past injustices of our country. If you're a patriot, you can't recognize the, you know, the sins of the past and so on. I argue that's false. What I call enlightened patriotism is deeply aware of our failings and tries to rectify and remedy them. So patriotism is consistent with a kind of the possibility of self-criticism and self and collective improvement. It's by no means just suggesting that everything's been hunky-dory for all times.
You bring up a wonderful vignette with Abraham Lincoln and the Quakers in your book. And that is one, honestly, that I have to work through as an Army officer, as, you know, the mother of sons of Army officers, as a wife of an Army officer. So the Quakers did not want to take up arms. And Abraham Lincoln basically did not know how to deal with it. We saw this again in Vietnam. And we saw it again even in Afghanistan, where a couple of defectors have been heralded as heroes. But in the end, they actually went AWOL. They defected from the Army. Can you talk to us a little bit about that conflict between the principles of conscientious objection and, you know, being a citizen of a country that depends upon you?
Well, I'm really delighted you picked that point up. Because the example you talk about with Lincoln and the Quakers, Mrs. Eliza Gurney, takes place in a part of the book where I'm talking about conflict, how loyalties can come into conflict. I use some examples from literature, from film, but I do like this historical example, actual example. Lincoln, he met in the White House in 1862, I believe it was, with Mrs. Eliza Gurney from Philadelphia and a delegation of the Quakers, where they spoke together for over an hour. And in a letter that he wrote to her about a year later, I think from 1863, he says, look, I appreciate your dilemma. The Quakers are against war, but they are also for emancipation. They are against slavery. You can't have one without the other. So you're in a dilemma. What should you do? If you support your faith, you cannot go to war. If you go to war, you seem to be turning on your faith in some ways. And Lincoln admitted he had no answer to this problem. He said, "I will do the best I can for the friends." He called them the friends. "I will do the best I can." And he appreciated the dilemma because it was a deep one. The claims of conscience are difficult in part because in some senses, in the case of Quakers, those in this case, anti-war views are deeply, deeply held. We know in other cases, people will invoke, you know, conscientious objection sort of as a, you might say, flag of convenience. How deep does it go? This is one of the difficulties. I mean, of using conscience as the standard, because conscience is a private standard. There's no public means of testing one's conscience, as it were. And of course, we've seen that throughout our history. The most famous example of the conscientious objector, probably Henry David Thoreau, his famous essay, Civil Disobedience, invoking the voice of conscience. In that case, it was against the Texas War, the Mexican War that was being inflamed at the time. And he said a law that did not pass his conscience was not worthy of his support. And of course, consciences played, you mentioned Vietnam, people were conscientious objectors more recently. In the case of the Quakers, I think there's a case of deep and conscientious purpose. And there are people like this, but also conscience is a very flexible standard and not one that can be readily applied or easily applied to public life. If I look at some of the challenges posed by people invoking conscience to make a voice of exception.
Ellen, you and I have a great experience with this as being committed Catholics. Mm-hmm. And being a committed Roman Catholic and a committed Roman American Catholic, a lot of times you have two loyalties. You have that are in conflict on many of the social issues. So in the recent years, we've seen where the Vatican has not acted fast enough, or especially in the child sex abuse cases, or where we've seen that the U.S. and some of their policies have gone against our Catholic sensibilities that are coming out of the Vatican. So, and that's always been a concern for Catholic political figures of where their loyalty lies. And I think those are actually genuine questions because, as you say, Stephen, these are questions of conscience.
Michelle, that is a valid point because throughout history, you have a lot of conflicts in the political world with faith questions and conscientious questions, and then how a government has some laws or rules that might be against them. What I like about the Quaker situation is I felt like in hearing the story that I didn't doubt their patriotism. I didn't doubt that in because they had a long history of being patriotic, but not in the sense of supporting war. So they kind of have history on their side where you wouldn't doubt their patriotism by the stance they took. However, in some individual cases, you might think, well, are they patriotic or they just really don't want to go to war? So I think there's some nuances from the personal opposing of war, let's say, versus the broad Quaker opposing of war. So I think it's an interesting juxtaposition in there. Stephen, how does patriotism look different in the United States versus, let's say, Europe or in other countries of the world? Does it look the same throughout all of these places today?
No, it doesn't. And one of the points I make in the book about patriotism, there's not just a kind of one-size-fits-all model. One is, which I think goes back to the ideas of the founders, which are central, there's an aspirational character to American patriotism. There's a belief that we are country based on equality, we are a country based on rights, we are a country based on individual freedoms and liberties. And of course, we know those have not always been fully or fairly applied. So we are, our patriotism has an aspirational quality to it. We are very concerned to extend patriotism or the inclusion in the American family to people who had been previously excluded because of their religion or their race, for example. So I think that is an important aspect to me of what distinguishes American patriotism from other kinds, is its aspirational and inclusive quality. One of the things that Lincoln argued in a number of speeches is that he said, in addressing immigrant groups of his time, and of course the immigrants he tended to be speaking to were German, Michelle, German immigrants who were coming here after 1848 in particular. He welcomed them to the table. He said, you know, what it takes to be an American is commitment to the principles of on which America stands. It's not based on where you come from, who your parents are, whether your family was here in 1776 or not. It was a big issue back then. Of course, not less today, but it had a sense of welcoming and inclusion, and I think that's very important to, as again, as a way not only what distinguishes American patriotism, its generosity, but also from what distinguishes it from nationalism.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, one thing that is, I had Europeans tell me all the time. They say there's two countries in the world that are flag crazy. And that is the United States and France. We love our flags. And, you know, and that is so true. And I just went back for a month back home to Alabama. And you see American flags everywhere. And I could go probably 3 weeks here without seeing one German flag. Now, Germany is a false country in a lot of ways. It's a conglomeration of kingdoms and fiefdoms, and it's only been around since 1871. But we are flag crazy. And if you go to France, every corner of France has a flag flying. And it might have their own region's flag, but there's definitely the French flag. So
you know from my book that I love because I mentioned it a couple of times in the book, I love the movie Casablanca. And there is no more moving scene in Casablanca. It always brings tears to my eyes when they sing the Mars, when the German officers are sitting around the piano singing, the Rhineland song. Then the French join in singing the Marseillaise. That is such a powerful moment to me. And,
oh, every time they sing the Marseillaise, tears come to their eyes. I mean, it's amazing. And you know what's happening in 2 days from now is June 6th, which is a great Patriot Day, a great, you know, the storming of beaches of Normandy. Mm-hmm. And so such a proud moment in the history of the United States. Stephen, can we get back to patriotism in our current divisive politics now? Mm-hmm.
One of the arguments I make is that it needs to be reclaimed from both the left and the right. The left, because they have largely rejected patriotism of any sort, is sort of, like I say, they think that patriotism means ignoring the sins of the past, sort of tub-thumping for America, America first, that sort of thing. It needs to be recaptured from the right. Once again, it's morphed into a kind of nationalism. And by that, I mean this kind of language that we hear all the time, friend and enemy, this group are enemies of the people. Patriotism doesn't speak to either of those claims. And I think the broad sensibilities basically the center to the center left and the center right of American public opinion and public sensibilities. And that is the reclaiming, I think, my book argues that we need to do at the moment. And at the end, in the last chapter, I talk about some ways in which we might try to reclaim it today in a more healthy way.
You're right. And we do need to find a healthy path forward in this so the conversation does not deteriorate. We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Smith. His book is Reclaiming Patriotism in the Age of Extreme. He's also a professor at Yale, the Alfred Coles Professor of Political Science. Dr. Smith, Stephen, thanks for joining us today on Convergence. We've really appreciated this conversation.
Ellen and Michelle, I loved it. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on your show. God bless you and you're doing God's work.
Thanks. Go fly your flag, right?
There you go.
That's right.
For Michelle McAloon, I'm Ellen Taylor. We'll talk to you next time on Convergence.